Good morning, breezy breakfast. Here we are. It is Thursday, July 14th. Today, we're going to be discussing the Home for Good campaign. And as we do that, I wanted to remind everyone of our friend Skylar Williams and his efforts at Lambach. One of the reasons that Lambach exists is because the Haudenosaunee are trying to bring their people home. In order to bring their people home, they need space to have people live with them. And as we are close neighbors, we are reminded that Guelph is situated on the traditional territories of the Attawandaran, the Haudenosaunee, and the Anishinaabe people, as well as the Treaty 3 territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. As we are talking about making sure that everyone has a home, let us remember there are many Indigenous people that are included that require housing. So today we are talking about the Home for Good campaign. It's a bold call to action to solve homelessness in our community. Our guests today are Dominika McPherson from the Poverty Task Force, or as the full name of it is, the Guelph and Wellington Task Force for Poverty Elimination. And Dominika is the director. As well, we have Glenna. Glenna is the executive director of the United Way for the Guelph, Wellington, Dufferin area. So they are going to provide us with an overview of the campaign, an update on the progress to date, and suggest ways that we can help ensure that every person has a home for good. So Dominika and Glenna, I know you guys have a prepared presentation for us. Please let us know about the Home for Good campaign.
Thanks so much, Morgan. I think I'm gonna go first. And anyway, it's always really amazing to join all of you. It's always an incredible space to be in when I feel like I'm in a space with people who might exceed my nerddom about civil politics and issues happening in the community. And I feel it's definitely a privilege to be able to join you multiple times. And please forgive me if I cover things today that some of you have heard before and arguably could probably be champions on. But I wanna make sure that in the case that there's anybody new here today that they've got some of that base knowledge as well. So I'm going to share a little bit of context, the broader context around the campaign, and then I'll hand it to Glenna afterwards to really champion the campaign and dig into what it's supporting in the community. But as many of you know, our community has been working a number of years on really working towards ending homelessness in our community. So our community has been working on ending homelessness for a number of years now. And I say that as a number of years because although efforts may have been underway to support people who do not have access to housing to find a place to call home, this was really representative of a pretty significant full system level kind of shift in our community where, under largely the leadership of the County of Wellington, but made possible by so many agencies on the front lines in our community, really making a concerted decision to shift from managing homelessness and, you know, really witnessing people in a constant cycle of which we know people are experiencing today as well, to really shifting towards housing focused solutions. So housing focused solutions being, putting in place programs to prevent people from entering homelessness into the first place, helping divert people from shelter, help make family connections or find places that are safe to stay. And then supporting people who are homeless now. And depending on the supports that they need and want, that could look like a number of different support-based programs, things like helping people cover their rent, first month's rent, helping people to find housing, or helping people to access programs that might be able to provide some additional support. So through those efforts and through those shifts in our community, we actually experienced some pretty significant success in terms of working people to honor what they wanted to see happen for their housing situation. People might be familiar with some of the system level kind of infrastructure that got put in place around this. So we have a by name list which at its simplest means we know people by name in our community. So individuals on that list have an existing relationship and connection, and people are really working to kind of identify that person's unique needs, because no one person's experience with homelessness looks the same. And we really need to get to know each person to know what they want, so that they can practice agency over their lives. So through that, we saw some pretty significant reductions. For example, we're incredibly close to ending youth homelessness in our community, which is huge. And through that work, though, we did identify that there was a number of community members who were experiencing homelessness who have really complex needs. Not of a fault of their own, but because we know that our systems are failing people, and that poverty being largely legislated means that people are experiencing crisis. And when you are living on a low income and you don't have a place to call home, we know that that has negative impacts on your health and well-being. And as a result, we have a number of people that have intersecting challenges, whether it's physical chronic illness, whether it's mental illness, whether addiction is a factor, and who need some additional support in order to maintain and access housing. We knew that the type of housing that would be needed for that would be permanent supportive housing. And really what permanent supportive housing is it's an evidence-based and cost-effective solution for people who are chronically homeless. So people who've been homeless for a long period of time. And normally it's particularly helpful for people with long-term disabilities, like the pieces that I spoke about earlier in terms of support needs. To break it down really practically, permanent, because the model has leases are held by tenants without a limit on stay. So that is their permanent place to call home until they would like otherwise. Supportive. So it links rental assistance. So often looking at rent supplements with access to individualized flexible supports that people can access as they need. And those are often provided on site in a 24/7 model. And that's largely the model that's kind of being looked at for some of the new projects coming online currently. And then housing. So they're often independent units. And in these cases, much of the projects happening in our community are in a shared building, but those are still people's individual homes. So now to do it a bit quicker, because I don't want to suck into Glenna's time. But Tanya, you had sent along some kind of great considerations in an email to me because I was snoopy and asked what would be most helpful. One of the things was criteria on how people would access those projects and buildings. That's something that is largely dictated based on someone's needs and what they want. So assuming someone's support needs align with what's available in the building, that person should be considered as a potential tenant of those buildings. These are people's homes. So when we talk about, I know people ask at times about rules and restrictions and things along those lines, people will have the same freedoms and rights within their housing unit as, for example, I would or one of you would. These are people's independent homes, and people are actively choosing to live there and access those supports as they need. And then beyond that, I know many of you are familiar with the depth of the housing crisis that we're experiencing in our community, and how frankly incredibly challenging it is to access land, access resourcing to actually build projects or renovate projects, have the providers that are willing to put their necks on the line to take a risk and champion something big of this nature. And we also know that it's just really challenging in a fast growing city with places to grow legislation putting pressure and huge private development for nonprofit developers in particular to get in there and have the resourcing necessary to provide a deeply affordable option. So just to lead it into Glenna in particular, so around this passion around our need for permanent supportive housing and many key players in our community across multiple different sectors, nonprofit, health, housing, all levels of government across party lines at a local level. Huge, incredible champions like Glenna and Chris and the folks at United Way and the Guelph Community Foundation, a whole bunch of partners came together, and some of you will be familiar that was was under the umbrella of the mayor's task force. And that space provided some extra leverage to bring key players on board who may not have been engaged to the same degree in the past. And we championed a collaborative approach through that. And through that work, three projects emerged. And we really see these projects as game changers for our community. So I think, Glenna, you're going to speak a little bit more about what those are. So I won't dive into that. But I think we know that there's a broader experience of homelessness in our community, and there are people who are struggling now. Some of those individuals will want and need to access these supportive housing units when they come online. Some will not and will need a different type of housing to meet their needs. But one of the things we know is that if we can provide wraparound care and supports to folks who are experiencing some of the greatest crisis and struggle right now, that will also provide greater capacity to our system and frontline workers to support more people. And we really want to center energy and focus around, frankly, whose lives are most at risk right now in our community. And we knew that, the solution to homelessness is housing and ensuring people have those life-saving critical supports online with it. And I'm happy to say that action has happened on that front. More work needs to happen to find operational dollars so that we have as much support as possible on site for folks. And then we have a final critical need, which is capital funding. We've seen incredible momentum from our community's collaborative shared approach and to many of you championing more broadly for us to overcome zoning approvals and to get government funding from multiple different sources to help bring these projects to fruition. But we know that more is needed, and we're really aiming in our community for these projects to be debt-free so that they can be sustained and not be constantly struggling with mortgages and pressure points, because these are nonprofit agencies. So sorry, Glenna, I took up so much space there, but I'm really passionate about this one, and I wanted to make sure I was trying to cover the different pieces that were asked for. And I will now hand it to Glenna to introduce you to the Home for Good campaign.
Thanks, Dominika. I actually wasn't going to share a presentation, but I think I'm going to share one slide, because just thinking about the three projects, I think a picture is worth a thousand words. I want to share pictures of the projects, so I'll just share in a moment. But such an honor to be here this morning. It's my first time attending the Breezy Breakfast, so thank you for having me. And I am here representing the Home for Good campaign in partnership with the Guelph Community Foundation. Chris was hoping to be here this morning as well, but unfortunately had an emergency situation. So I am here representing both organizations this morning. So first off, I was just going to share a little bit about the three projects, because I think that some people are more familiar maybe with some more than others. So just a bit of an overview. We have three amazing projects that are planned in our community. The one that I think most people know about is probably Grace Gardens, which is the one on the left here, which is being led by Stepping Stone. And this is the renovation of the Parkview Motel on Woolwich. And it's a really great design. If you've driven past there recently, the construction is underway. It's going to have shared amenities, gathering spaces, community kitchen, laundry and family style seating where people can share meals together, and offices and private consultation rooms for staff to meet with residents privately for those support services that they need. And then the one in the center is the Bellevue Supportive Housing Project, which is being led by Wyndham House, and it's focused on supporting youth. They're often survivors of trauma and may need help to manage mental health and addiction issues. And it will be staffed by caring adults 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's actually one of the first supportive housing facilities of its kind in the country, which is designed specifically for youth based on the best research. So that's something that's actually really exciting for our community, that, you know, we are doing some stuff here that's really innovative across Canada. The one on the right is the Kindle Communities project, which is being led by Kindle. And this is in the Sheldale neighborhood, and it's actually a brand new build. It's going to be a 5-story supportive housing facility, and it will include 3,000 square feet of shared space for residents, community kitchens, indoor and outdoor eating areas, bike storage, cultural and spiritual rooms and spaces. It will be fully accessible, purpose-built apartment building, which is both affordable and fully integrated into the Sheldale community. So with all three of these projects, 72 individuals are going to be housed in our community, which is incredibly exciting for our community. These projects do require capital to get them to the finish line, of course, but really exciting news is that we're actually almost there. So thanks to all levels of government and some other community supporters, we're actually 80% of the way there to build all three of these projects. And in total, we're looking at about a $24 million budget to build all three of these projects together. And we're about 80% of the way there. And so we're really excited to be here, United Way and the Community Foundation, to really talk about getting these projects to the finish line so that they can come to life. And why United Way and why Guelph Community Foundation? We actually, as organizations, stepped up when the pandemic first hit to step up to urgent needs and establish the Community Response Fund. And it really showed us that as, you know, partners, we can do so much more together. Both of our organizations have been funders in the community for a long time, but it was a new way of working together. And we're really happy to be leading this campaign together. So obviously, based on what Dominique has shared, we can't understate the importance of these projects. That by name list, it's been, I think, I'm going to say, it's been around between, I think, like a 140-ish, maybe a bit higher now. But we are sort of looking at that by name list being reduced by about 50% with these projects, which is really exciting. Dominica can update there because she probably is more aware of the more current numbers. It might be up higher because of some current circumstances. But regardless of where that number is at, it's still incredibly impactful in our community, and especially those people that have those needs that these wraparound services will help support. So the one thing that's really exciting, we are raising $5 million with our campaign, and that actually goes above those capital costs that we need to bring these projects to life. So a portion of what we're funding is going to make sure that these buildings are able to be built mortgage-free, as Dominica said, which is super exciting. We are also raising a bit of a contingency fund for each project to help with ongoing maintenance and supports for the projects that they need so that they have that stability. And then the other thing we're doing is starting to think about what's next. So 20% of what we're raising is going to be a responsive fund because we know this isn't the complete solution. So we're going to start sort of seeding that money for when we're looking at what is needed and what are the remaining gaps that we'll have a bit of that funding available to act fast. What we've really learned with these three projects is that timing has been an incredible challenge because you never know when you're going to have an opportunity like purchasing a hotel to renovate it or certain government opportunities for funding. And we've been really kind of behind and trying to be adaptive and responding as best as we can. But being able to have that money up front will help us leverage other aspects of funding. And that's something that's been helpful to us in the process so far in sort of unlocking some government funding to ensure that they will be mortgage free. So we're investing not only in these 72 housed individuals, but the next step. And we're really excited about that. So when Dominica talks about ending homelessness, solving homelessness, we're really trying to think about these 72 and then that next piece as well. One piece, it's as Dominica said, it's required partners at the table with all different levels of government, businesses, nonprofit organization. It's really been a community effort, which is really exciting. And with the Kindle project, for example, we've had incredible assistance by Skyline, who not only donated the land, but has given an incredible amount of time to help with the planning process with their sort of staff and expertise. So everyone really is on board with helping to bring these projects to life. As Morgan said in the intro, Home for Good is a bold call to action to everyone for us to solve homelessness. And we do really think that this is a great, incredible opportunity for our community. And we're honored to have the opportunity to raise the funds that are needed to make that happen. You may have seen in the news last week, but we were really proud to announce a transformational gift from St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, who recently gifted $600,000 to the campaign. And to receive this gift so soon after the public launch, it really, I think, was a sign that community really sees the benefits and need for these projects. And they, as an organization, have actually been looking at the needs of the community and particularly around housing. And once they heard about the campaign, really felt this was the best way to kind of put that money to use that they had in helping to provide essential housing for our community. So we really hope that others that are in the community that are equally invested in solving homelessness will join St. Andrew's and other funders on this incredible community opportunity. So at this time, we will definitely be happy to answer questions. And but I'll just say to wrap up, obviously this is a campaign. So if you know someone who is ready to act and may be interested in contributing to the campaign, I would love to talk to you. We do actually have some getting back to the timelines. Because of some of the government funding, it has timelines on it. So we actually need to raise this money super fast. And we've kind of thrown out all your traditional timelines and rules with capital campaigns because we've just had to roll with it. So I totally believe that we can do it. But we will be fundraising quite fast. And so if there is anyone who would like to find out more about how you can contribute to the campaign, or if you know anyone else, we'd really appreciate those introductions. And building on some of the things that Dominika said at the beginning, we are really trying through the campaign to really share with the community that we know that homelessness is a system failure and not an individual one. And anything that we can do along with raising the funds, but to increase empathy will really, I think, be helpful to our community. We really believe that homelessness is solvable and that Guelph Wellington County can really lead the country in finding solutions, and really excited to share this with you today and to invite you to get on board and help people be home for good.
Thank you so much, Dominika and Glenna. And just with saying that you've got to do things a little more quickly this time, what is sort of the deadline in order to be able to access the things that need to be accessed?
So we have certain amounts that we need to raise by the end of March. So that sort of really things are moving along in the way that we've got sort of risk management, that we're feeling confident that we will be able to get there, but we are really hoping to raise the $5 million by the end of March. And the exciting part of that as well is that people should be living in all three of these projects. I think all 72 combined, you know, by 2023. So the at various staggered timelines over that. But I think groundbreaking is going to be happening with the Kindle project in the next month or so. So it has been interesting, but we've been lining things up as quickly as we can. But we are striving to raise the $5 million by the end of March.
Okay. So end of March is when we are looking to make sure that this $5 million is in place. Now, Dominika, Glenna was referencing the buy list name, and could you just let us know what the most recent count was and when that count occurred?
Yeah, I'm glad I have it because so this all is that data is managed by the County of Wellington. So originally the Poverty Task Force was a primary partner lead with the County of Wellington in getting this work started, but they are now the official lead and we champion it the best we can in the community. But I was in a committee meeting recently, and I believe this was last month. So one of the other things too is part of this system being in place is that we have real-time data So there's a lot of jargon with this work, but what real-time data essentially means is that we have a sense of how many people are known to our system that are experiencing homelessness on an ongoing basis. So right now on the by name list, I think the last data I got available to me was 164 people. But then within those 164 people, 131 of those individuals are chronically homeless. So that's another thing to keep in mind too. Is because some people will have been familiar that we did a point in time count last year, and the number of people identified was 270. It's important to know that at any given time, it's likely that there's a larger number of people experiencing homelessness, but we actually know that a large portion of people who experience homelessness actually self-resolve. Because we know that people enter into homelessness for a number of different factors and reasons, and people are often able to figure something out with family, try and identify new solutions. That's getting harder in the context of our housing crisis and the pandemic putting extra pressure on that. But when we're largely talking about, and Glenna was talking about around 140, we're really talking about people who are chronically homeless. And it's because this campaign is focused on supportive housing, in particular, this type of housing. And those are individuals who we see experiencing homelessness for a longer period of time because they face disproportionate barriers to being able to access and maintain housing in our community and need those extra supports. So last was 131 people experiencing chronic homelessness. And I think another fun fact just from the data as well is that we actually over recent periods of time seen an increase in the number of people being housed in our community, which is probably quite shocking considering how difficult it is to find an affordable place to call home. But it speaks to the significance of different. Oh, Mike, thank you so much for joining. Oh, and Mike, the thanks goes all the way back to you. I think it's important. I'm sure people in this room know this, but you have been an incredible champion who has been fiercely advocating for us and these projects at the provincial level. And we are incredibly grateful, hugely, hugely grateful. All right. So, sorry, I got off what I was focused on there, but and that's through the importance of different policy and support related programs for rent supplements. Right. But I think at the same time, having rent supplements through government programs, subsidizing, you know, private market rentals where the rents are going up and up and up is not necessarily sustainable either. Right. So we need these deeply affordable housing options in our community.
And just for our listening audience, the mic that Dominika was referring to is our MPP, Mike Schreiner. He was here very briefly to just let us know that he really does care, and he put a message in the chat. So for all of those that are listening, what Mike had to say is, I have to leave for another meeting, but I want to take a moment to sincerely thank Dominika and the Poverty Task Force for her leadership to push for solutions to the homelessness crisis in our community. And to Glenna at the United Way and Chris at the Community Foundation for their leadership in raising funds to make these projects a reality. I know the Breezy Breakfast team care deeply about social justice. Big thanks to everyone for your work on this important issue. So that's a message from our MPP, not only to the Poverty Task Force and those working on Home for Good, but to all of us that are a part of Breezy Breakfast as well. So back to the topic at hand. So we do have one question. Has the campaign connected with anyone on the 100 men or women group to help with fundraising? Is this a group that you're aware of, Glenna?
Thank you for suggesting that, whoever mentioned that. We actually haven't yet connected on the campaign, but that is a very good idea. I have connected with them on various different sections of those groups, but they definitely should be on our radar. So I'll make note of that. Thank you.
I'm just wondering if you could go back, Glenna, and explain a little bit about the phrase that you used, fully accessible. What does that mean to these projects?
I'm definitely not the expert in this area. Dominika may be able to answer that a bit better than myself, but that might be a follow-up because that is wording from the Kindle project and I'm not fully understanding of what that is. I am going to follow up with Erin, but I'll see if Dominika can expand on that at all.
Yeah, I can give a little bit of context. I would agree. I think it's best to touch base with the projects in particular. I know that it's definitely been something that's been, accessibility has been something that's been talked about from the beginning in terms of these projects and the importance of that. But what is that? Because we know that a lot of our standards that dictate accessibility fall incredibly short in terms of encompassing the diversity of disabilities that exist for people and have a really close link to people's access to housing and ability to maintain housing. I'll get off a soapbox on ranting about that one, but I know that it's been something that's been considered by all three projects. I think they're trying to center the needs of the individuals who will be accessing their spaces. I know specifically for Kindle, because I recently asked a question about this with them, is that they're thinking about accessibility also from a lens of age and place. And I think more broadly recognizing that, you know, anybody could experience a disability if you're not experiencing one now, in the future, at any moment. But I think that there's a component of definitely, there's requirements for accessibility for a lot of the government funding that has been included. And I know Kindle in particular, just, and it's only because I talked to Kindle recently about this, I can't speak to the others, but really wanted to work on exceeding those requirements. And I know in some areas they have, I can't speak to specifically which ones they are, but I know, I think they exceeded the number of physically accessible units and have put in some place some additional considerations. But Erin, I know you're an incredible champion for a number of different disabilities. And I'm not sure to what lens environmental sensitivities, for example, have been considered or things along those lines, but I know projects have been really open to considering the needs of folks who would be entering and wanting to be really intentional about that. But on the accessibility front, there's always more that can be done. And I would put a bold call to broader housing development and housing solutions in our communities to think about those from the beginning.
We do have a little question here, wondering if there's any indication that Guelph's reputation as a caring community is attracting underserved clients from other communities. So I think what this question's kind of getting at is, there's a perception that because Guelph is a caring community, that individuals come into our city from other places. Are you able to speak to that, either Dominika or Glenna?
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. Yeah, this is it's a great question. And I mean, I'm always somebody who's a firm believer that everybody should have a place to call home. And that people, regardless of how marginalized or alienated they are from society and community spaces, should be able to choose where they want to live and what community they want to be in. And I know that ours is a pretty great one. So if people are coming here, I don't blame them. However, on that point, I know that that's something that our community and specifically the work happening behind the scenes at a system level with the County of Wellington and service providers are considering on a regular basis and trying to identify how many people are coming from other communities. And they do that for a number of different reasons. One is we know that people having support systems and support systems that are, connections in their lives, connection to family, especially Morgan, you did a beautiful entry in terms of identifying unique experiences of Indigenous homelessness, having connection to community and culture. So when people, it is identified that someone's coming from another community and assuming there's connection and relationship building with service providers in our community, there's often efforts to try and identify, is there somewhere that person could be or would like to be and stay with family, or perhaps they're here because of accessing an institution and this is where they were dropped off or this is where they were given a bus ticket to. People don't always have the resources to get to where they need to be or want to be and can be. So there are efforts at times to support people if they have a family that they could stay with but don't have the financial resources to travel there. to provide them with those supports, because we know if people can connect to caring spaces, whether that's in our community or elsewhere, that that can help people to prevent and exit homelessness. I think in additionally, though, I would say that, and I don't want to misquote this one, but I do believe that in looking at it more recently, most a number of the people that are entering into homelessness in our community are from this community. So that's shifted to varying degrees in the past, and at times that can be related to what's happening in other communities in terms of their service pressures or their ability to respond to need. But many of the people experiencing homelessness in our community are from this community. And we know that the housing pressures, what was it, rentals.ca, I think was, there was a news article on it a couple months ago that a bachelor unit since last year has gone up 20% in like average rental costs. Like there's very clear factors that are contributing to people facing pressure and being entering into homelessness in our community. So I don't have specifics on that per se, but my understanding is that the majority of people are from our community and are facing pressures in our community. And even though we have some really incredible programs that are supporting people to not lose their housing and to not enter into the shelter system and find the supports that they need, and some really incredible people that are able to find solutions themselves. Yeah. Anyway, it's a great question. I'm sorry I don't have specifics on that, but that's just some of the considerations around it and what that looks like.
Okay. Thank you for that. Now, there has been a lot of talk about the shift of where services are being provided and the visibility in our downtown core. I know that this was just brought up at City Council, and Dominica, you've been asked to head a subcommittee. How is this project interconnected with how the subcommittee is going to look at things?
So I don't have a ton of answers, because we're still figuring things out and trying to figure out what the best way is to support action. And I wanna let you know there is a sense of urgency behind this. I think how this connects to kind of the broader permanent supportive housing work, I wouldn't say there's a direct link per se to Home for Good, but is we know that part of the reason why we need these root cause solutions of permanent supportive housing is because people are facing significant crisis. And this is, and I don't want to be extreme about this, but these are life and death experiences. And that's why our community has had a sense of urgency of finding people a place to call home that meets their needs. We take a housing first approach in our community that recognizes until people have a place to call home and a roof over their head, it can be very challenging to access additional supports and manage additional pieces to help support you to reach stability. But at the same time, it means that until these types of housing are available, some of these individuals do not have a place to call home, or some of these individuals do have a place to call home, but don't have access to the supports that they need in their housing. Because this is another thing with a housing first approach, everybody is doing what they can to find someone with that place to call home and align supports as the best as possible. But we do know pressures, especially in our health system and in broader systems in the context of the pandemic, has been strained significantly with lack of resourcing at being one of the most predominant components of it. So the connection to this, frankly, is that, and I don't want to get into saying it's the case because I don't know this in particular, but is we have individuals in the meantime who are facing crisis, and the downtown core is a great place for community, and it's also a great place to access with transit. It's a great place with public services. And it's a great place with service agencies and support agencies. And frankly, I think for some of the same reasons that I like being in the downtown core, people who are facing crisis also like being in the downtown core. So how does this connect to this work? It connects to it because people have immediate needs now. That includes housing, but it also includes access to health services. It includes access to supports. It includes access to basic needs, washroom. The pandemic, everybody said, well, how do we do this? We stay home and we wash our hands as much as possible. Many of you have heard me say this before. You can't stay home if you don't have a home. You can't wash your hands if you don't have access to water and a sink and a washroom. So these immediate needs are pressing point now. We know, I'm a very firm believer that we need to eliminate poverty, not to be just because it's the right thing to do, or because it will increase the well-being of people who are facing those extreme pressures now, and frankly will save people's lives. But I also know that it supports a happier, healthier, more thriving community, which also links to a more supported economy because people have money in their pockets and the capacity to spend in their local communities, which we know people who face low incomes or in low wage precarious jobs, that's where they spend their money with local businesses, local services to meet their basic needs. So there is always a broader connection to, and I know someone referenced local businesses, to local businesses who I love and adore. And I think we need to really wrap care around people right now. We need to respect people. We need to center their experience, wants, and needs. And I think we need to really focus on caring for people right now. We know that our systems being broken in many ways are contributing to these issues existing in the first place. And it also means that whether it's intended or not, that greater value is placed on my life, for example, than someone who's facing significant mental health crisis or addiction by nature of the poverty and extreme marginalization that they're facing. And I think that there's space for us to center folks who are facing this crisis right now, and we can support that. And I know we are in a very challenging policy and governance environment with the different levels of government, particularly our provincial government, and the need for greater action on that front and resourcing and investments in our communities to care for people and support people so everyone in our community can thrive. But within our pressures that we're facing now and the existence of what we have now, and I want to acknowledge frontline workers are working so hard. System leaders are working so hard. And the fact that they are still working in the context of a pandemic that has not been caring to them either, I'm going to start crying about that one because people are hurting so much right now. And it's people on the ground that are being most impacted. But it's also very hard and stressful for people that are in roles to try and support folks and to change systems. It's not easy work. I'm worried that things are going to get worse. But I think in that context, we can direct rage where it needs to go right now, which is on those who hold decision-making power and resourcing at provincial levels and at system levels. And we need to have a lot of love, and we need to spread that around wherever we can right now. And that includes on where there might be pressures in our community among different groups. And I think we need to show love for one another because everybody is having a hard time. But I think who's having our hardest time right now are people who are in crisis right now and whose lives are at risk. And many of those individuals are in the downtown core. And many of those individuals know what they want and know what they need. And I know that we can do better. And I know people want to do better. And I know we can align what we currently have to better support those needs. And I also want to acknowledge that with our systems being broken, no one is best positioned to solve the crisis people are facing right now. It's people are facing significant crisis and unlike what we've seen to the same degree in the past. And it means people's lives are at greater risk. But in that, that can make it really scary to put your hand up and say, our system is going to solve this, but we can't do it alone. We need to do it together, and we need to acknowledge that we can do better if we work on this together. And no one is responsible alone, but we need all system players, all levels of government, all key players. I don't know if there's businesses in the audience, but businesses can play a critical role to advocate to the provincial government right now and talk about how we need to value people's lives and value their well-being, because it is also an economic issue. And if we can center things on supporting people who are in crisis and struggling right now, we will have a supported and thriving business community. We will have a supported and thriving downtown core. And I imagine many of you will also be happier because who wants to know that degree of infringing on people's rights and denying them access to basic human dignity feels good? It doesn't. And I know we can do something about it. And I mean, that's a lens that I am hoping I can bring to that conversation. And I know people want to do something. And I think the mayor's task force and the mayor in wanting to kind of launch this and listen to key players in our community who are asking for a greater sense of urgency to champion that. It's hard for me to say no to that one. So I'm going to try and support and try and bring people together and you know, create some love in that space as well, because I know that if we work together, we can try and do better even within what is a really difficult situation.
we were just talking about the visibility. And we used to have the welcome in drop in that wasn't right in the downtown core. Now the majority is right in the downtown core. So as we're waiting for these three wonderful projects to come online, it's kind of a two-parter question. Where do the people that aren't housed tend to spend their time in your experience? And also, what type of interim temporary solutions are being used at the moment while we're in sort of this holding pattern until next year when we have so many wonderful units come online?
Yeah. So people are where they want to be because it's meeting their needs, right? So that could be different things for different people. We know that the welcome in drop-in closed because they shifted their focus. It's now an overnight emergency shelter. I do want to draw attention though that a lot of the agencies that are open now were open before the pandemic as well. And there were fewer that were open and available. However, I'm also happy to share as kind of the behind the scenes coordinator of the hot and cold weather responses in our community to support people to access warming or cooling locations in emergency shelter that we just added three of those locations back on. So in addition to Royal City, we also have the overnight shelter at the former Welcome and Drop-In, so Stepping Stones Emergency Shelter Overnight. We have Wyndham House's Youth Shelter, which is 24/7 right now. Chalmers has a space cafe that they've reopened on Tuesdays. Hope House is open, I believe it's Monday to Thursday. And not only that, we actually have more locations than we did before the pandemic, because in the context of the pandemic, the City of Guelph offered City Hall as another option and are working to fill gaps when there's extreme heat warnings on Sundays. And then we also have the libraries. And when I say that there's multiple locations, the reason why I value that is because it provides people with greater choice, because not everybody will want to access all of those places, feel comfortable accessing all of those places. And when we have choice, that can give people greater dignity and access to what they need. With that said, Morgan, I know that there's been some feelings of services being concentrated. I want to remind these services were there before the pandemic. The way people access them may look differently. And I think one of the things that I get a little nervous about when we start talking about the location of services and where they're located in our city, I get fearful that we're considering a conversation of moving things. And when we move the critical supports that people need, then we're moving people. Right. And I think we want to make sure that we're never denying people their rights and their dignity as human beings. And that means people need to have freedom to go where they want to go in public spaces and to access the services they need and want. And I think rather than considering where services are located, I am sure you all know this, but it's much easier when the locations and the basic needs you need met are within close different distance of one another, when you don't have access to transportation, or if you're unwell and in incredible chronic pain. Having these services and the meals that you need or the supports that you need in close proximity to one another is an incredibly helpful thing. And it means people are better aligned to access the supports that they need. But I think the other thing too is in this broader conversation, we need to center around the individuals who need support right now. And that doesn't mean necessarily talking about locations. It means ensuring that the supports people need are located where they need them, for sure. And I know service providers are having those conversations, but we need to figure out how best to meet the needs people have right now. And to your question around kind of immediate actions, we've got some great kind of frontline worker related programs. We need to ensure that there are frontline workers. People are experiencing staff shortages right now. We need to make sure agencies are better resourced to be able to pay people more because costs are going up, and to support people and make sure that people are not burning out and agencies are doing all that they can to care for their employees. I know we have a lot of very caring agencies in our community, but this is impacting everybody. But I think ensuring frontline workers are located in the downtown core who are there to provide supports, to build relationships and connections with people. And I think the agencies that are doing that now are doing a great job around those pieces. But one of the biggest reasons why people come downtown is a sense of community, which is why it's not just a homelessness issue. It's a poverty issue. It's a mental health issue. It's a health crisis. Because some people are housed, but they miss people. They miss their community, and their community is located in the downtown core where you can share a meal with someone, or you can have a coffee with someone at Royal City, or you can sit in the beautiful square and feel comfortable in your community space. But at the same time, we need to ensure that people have a place to call home, have the supports that they need, and can feel a sense of community in those spaces. Because just as I can come home and use substances as I want in the privacy of my living room, or wherever, not everybody has that availability to them. And public spaces are some of the few spaces that are available to everyone. And if you don't have a place to call home, that may be your only option. And I think if you talk to people, talk to people who are experiencing pressures, and I know in my relationships with folks, they want to support a caring community just as much as anyone else, and don't want to make people uncomfortable, because what I hear from people is already that they feel alienated and not welcome in society. So the last thing people want to do is make people feel uncomfortable. But we know that stigma is really strong. And we know some of those discriminatory views about people who are facing that crisis are really strong, and that builds fear in our community. And that's where empathy, love, and caring, and busting some of those myths and helping to build wraparound care around people who are facing the greatest crisis right now is going to get us there. And I think we've got some incredible agencies in the downtown core that are helping to make that possible.
I agree with you, Dominika. One of the things that I actually really enjoy doing when I'm downtown is having conversation with the people that spend most of their time downtown and finding out a little bit about their life. It's always a great way to understand more about our community when we have the opportunity to speak with individuals. Glenna, I'd like to give you a brief moment to just say out loud the link to where people can go if they would like to donate to the Home for Good campaign. I know that you've got that great start with the donation from the One Church, and hopefully a more faith-based community will join in with them. How does the little guy, like anybody here today or listening to us on radio or podcast, connect with the campaign and donate to help?
Thanks, Morgan. So we have a website, homeforgoodgw.ca. So there's more information about the campaign there. And if anyone is comfortable with doing so, you can donate online through the website. You can also get in touch with Chris or I. Our contact information is on the website. But also you can reach out to me at glenna@unitedwayguelph.com, and happy to chat about any contribution level. As we've talked about, it's gonna take a community effort to bring these projects to life, and every contribution is valued and appreciated. And it was actually an interesting conversation we had with St. Andrews, because they wanted to use their gift to try to motivate other gifts, and didn't want someone who, let's say, wanted to contribute $5 to think that their gift wasn't worthwhile because they were contributing that gift. They had this legacy gift they were able to give because of the sale of another building, and they were really honored to be able to do that. But they want to encourage people of all giving levels to support the campaign. And it's something that's really important to us through the campaign as well, with how we recognize donors. We're really challenging ourselves to kind of let go of some of those traditional recognition elements with a campaign. We want everyone to feel that their donation is needed and appreciated as part of the campaign, because it really is a community effort. So happy to chat with anyone, and any gift is appreciated.
Thank you so much for that, Glenna. So I'm just wondering, what do we say to people that say we need to stay in our silo, that housing isn't a municipal issue, it's a provincial issue? And also along those lines, as we're doing all of this charity work, how can we differentiate the Task Force on Poverty from being a charity organization that, or an organization that's promoting a charity solution to an organization that's actually working on social justice?
I'll maybe just say a little piece, and then I'm sure Dominika will add to that. But I did add a little piece in the chat that, you know, I think that there is a lot that has fallen on the shoulders of, you know, nonprofit organizations, grassroots organizations, and, you know, that various levels of government do need to step up. You know, there's certain services in our community that we are proud to fund, but I think is rather ridiculous that we need to. The fact that, you know, we are the major funder for the distress line. You know, like, these are services that if something was to happen to our fundraising, if we weren't able to follow through on that, it's been quite stressful for us over the last couple of years when fundraising is challenging. So I think that finger pointing or staying in lanes, it's just not something that's a reality in today's environment. We are happy to be at the table. That's one of the things that we're really excited about with these projects, is that it really has been a collective effort with all levels of government, you know, private sector, individuals, nonprofits. So I think if we are really going to move things forward, everyone has to be at the table, and we can't just say, no, this is your problem or your responsibility, that we all need to be there together. But I'm sure Dominika will add more to that.
Yeah. So the two pieces is, one, it's not, if someone's saying it's not a municipal issue, I guess the other is shifting from charity to social justice. The municipal piece in particular, it is obviously a municipal issue. And I will amplify what Glenna is saying, is that, you know, we all need to work together on this, and all levels of government need to work together on this. I also think all levels of government have a responsibility to act on this within the different levers and mechanisms they have available to them. And that includes all levels of government. So specifically, when we think municipal governments at a local level here, we've got the city of Guelph and the county of Wellington. County of Wellington is our municipal service manager, which means they provide the delivery of provincial programs, social programs, and under that umbrella includes housing and homelessness. And then the city of Guelph, although the county provides housing and homelessness supports, and specifically when we think about, I don't want to get into a whole big thing here, but when we think about the continuum, the housing continuum, there's different types of housing, and that ranges from emergency shelter up to, you know, rent geared to income, or social housing, or community housing, which are all terms for relatively the same thing. Then you've got, you know, affordable rental context, affordable ownership, private, and then you might have market cost rental and market cost ownership. So when we think about that kind of full spectrum of need, the county as a social service manager is responsible for those deeper, more deeply affordable options, right? So that community housing, social housing, emergency shelter programs, transitional housing, things along those lines. And then they may deliver some programs that help to supplement people's access to the rental market. So through things like rent supplements. However, when we think about the city of Guelph, and the city of Guelph has a commitment and a plan on affordable housing, that it's the rental market, the private rental market, and including affordable rentals and affordable ownership, as where the city has a lot of levers to be able to act on that and look at that as a responsibility. So those two municipal partners can play a critical role in working in tandem to try and ensure that we've got affordable options and options that meet the spectrum of needs in our community. So for example, we could be really innovative locally, and the city could consider their definition of affordable housing, rather than linking it to market level costs, could consider the income levels in our community and ensure that that is grounding policy choices with zoning, bylaws, incentives, to ensure that we are having the development reflect needs to meet the income levels of people in our community, rather than having growth, frankly, push people out or gentrify in some setting. And that's happening in some contexts, right? And that's because of broader factors, which is where I won't put all the responsibility on the city and county, but where the provincial government has frankly downloaded a ton onto over the years from multiple different parties and governments onto municipalities, giving them very few options and pressures at the same time, right? One of the few sources of funding beyond property taxes municipalities can leverage are development charges. So how do we ensure that if cities are needing to collect development charges, that it's not creating a disproportionate barrier for deeply affordable housing to be created? So all levels of government have a role to play, and that definitely includes municipal government. And I think it can get really complicated, but there are some really clear ways that those municipalities can look at it. Phil, I know you've been a champion, but I will always put a plug in for both the city and county having staff dedicated towards looking at affordable housing options in our community across the continuum of need and in the areas that they hold responsibility. Okay, and then on the charity to social justice, that one I could go on a whole big thing about, and I'm going to not. There are charitable responses, there are social justice responses. As a poverty task force, we really value social justice and try to apply that lens in our work. And that's why our mission is to support local action when needed. But for the most part, what we want to do is system and policy change to address the root causes of poverty. And one of the risks with charity, you know, meeting emergency needs is critical. We need to always be meeting people's basic needs and be doing that in a caring way. And we need to have the same sense of urgency for root cause solutions. So those strategies need to happen in tandem. And charitable responses can shift towards more social justice responses as well through, you know, centering the agency, dignity, and needs of people so that they have full choice. And some agencies in our community have done some incredible work moving in that direction to really center people's wants, needs, and choice so that they have input over what that looks like, so that we're not perpetuating or risking perpetuating, power dynamics that can further marginalize or make people's experience in accessing supports degrading. And I know nobody's intending for that to happen, but it can happen. And I know nobody wants to make that happen. And I think looking to social justice approaches is one of our primary ways to get there.
Excellent. So I'm going to ask Glenna if she can just restate a little bit. We've got the $24 million for capital, and there's the $5 million Home for Good campaign, a portion of which is being held for something else. So if you could please restate for us what that sort of mix is and how the operating costs of these facilities are going to be met. And after you finish that, I am going to ask our counselor, Phil Ault, to just let us know a little bit about how the changes that are being brought in by the comprehensive zoning bylaw that was brought to City Council last night can tie in with that. So Glenna, if you can give us a little bit of an understanding of the full cost, the capital, and the operating costs, where those are going to come from in the future.
Yes, great question. So the $5 million that we're raising, it's actually being split 60%, 20%, 20%. So 60% of that covers the remaining capital costs to build the three projects. And then 20% will be distributed between the three projects as reserves. So this is actually not operating, but more operational reserves for repairs and maintenance to the actual structures of the building to make sure that, you know, those needs are covered. And then the final 20% is that responsive fund. And just building on, I saw a couple of comments about tiny homes or other opportunities. So it's something that, you know, after these three projects are done, we'll be looking at sort of the unique needs that remain with those individuals that need to be housed. And that will be really led, you know, by the county and the key partners with identifying sort of what those opportunities are. And as funders, we just want to be ready to jump on those as soon as we know. So we really don't know, but we're just going to hold that so we're ready and can act fast. And then when it comes to operating, it is actually at various stages for each project, but a lot of that operating dollars come from government funding because it is health funding or various other funding pots. So that isn't something that we are looking at with Home for Good. And there is some continued and important advocacy happening with the government right now around the to make sure that the funding is there to have those ongoing operating costs, specifically with those support services, the wraparound support services. And then from our perspective as United Way, we do have, you know, from the funds that we raise on an annual basis, funding that we provide to the three housing partner organizations that help with ongoing costs. So we're kind of at the table, but not necessarily through Home for Good, through our Poverty to Possibility funding stream that we raise through our annual campaign. So yeah, I just want to differentiate. It's very important that we advocate for and ensure that the projects have those costs that they need for operating. And it will be something that we will continue to work on over time.
Wonderful. Thank you for giving us a little bit more understanding of how that all works, Glenna. Counselor Phil, last night we had the presentation of the comprehensive zoning bylaw review. How does that tie in to what we're talking about today?
Well, it's thanks, Morgan. I want to go over that very slowly, I think, because I think that there are a number of issues that have been raised in this very, very important discussion that I think need to be unpacked. And I think we can start with what was done last night. I think what was done by council last night was historic and positive. And I asked Krista Walkie, our head of planning, to characterize what was done. And I gave her a frame of, is this status quo conservative? Is this cautious? Is it radical? And I was happy and surprised when she said, it's rad. And she was very clear that this was a frame that she wanted to put on it. It did not go as far perhaps as many people would have wanted, but what it did do was, and I think that this is incredibly important, it moved us from something which for all intents and purposes was exclusive zoning to inclusive zoning. And that means that we are essentially freeing up land for the development of any kind of housing in a similar neighborhood. We are not going to constrain ourselves as we have in the past. And that's really important. It means that semis and apartments and single family dwellings can exist in the same area, and houses which we might have characterized as monster houses aren't necessarily going to be as ubiquitous as they are in the past. They might actually in some senses be side by side with a dwelling of a similar square footage that is three or four apartments. And that to me is very positive. But I want to be clear, because I think Dominique raised a very, very important issue here. Municipalities can only do so much. Depending upon how you look at it, the city's budget right now is between 4 and 8% for social services and housing directed toward the county. That's a significant amount of money. It's about $15 to $17 million every budget cycle. And I think that the point that Dominique raised that whatever level of government is responsible for this should have the housing is absolutely correct. We need to do that. Equally important, and by the way, it is a county in this case, not the city. We have assumed responsibility for the ambulance services, and we have directed the county to assume responsibility for social services and housing, because we, and this is a failure of our government system in some senses. Without regional government, we have to do this. In Waterloo, Region Waterloo is very clear what the authorities are. But zoning isn't going to solve everything. we are at a position where I would say that we need at this point at least 5,000 houses that are supported, that are funded by the federal and provincial government, if we want to see a reduction in the actual cost of houses in this area. And both the federal and the provincial government have failed this. So while the city can set up inclusive zoning, and while the county can provide for the staff, if the money is not there, we are going to have a problem that is going to repeat itself. Because let's be honest, municipalities can only do so much. We are tremendously curtailed in our capacity to tax. If we could tax differently, we might be able to do things differently. Whereas my house, my taxes on my house are about $4,000, $5,000. My income tax is, and my wife's income tax is somewhere in the area of $25,000. That should show people the difference in the taxation levels. What inclusive housing does, it allows us to turn parking lots, church parking lots, for example, into housing if we have the money. But those churches and those charities need the federal government to radically change its housing program, not just for supportive housing, but for all kinds of housing. As I've listened to this, what I'm as concerned about with regards to those that do not have housing of any kind is those who are underhoused. And people should be very, very concerned about what came out from Stats Canada yesterday, which is the number of people that are living with roommates of a certain age now, not because they want to, but because they must. Similarly, we should be very, very concerned that children are not leaving home until their 30s. Now, I've got to say, you know, I love our kids. I'm also glad that they've left home. And at some point, they're also glad that they've left home as well. And that doesn't mean that I don't believe in the extended family. I was raised in one. If it was not for my grandmother, I wouldn't be the person that I was, because she raised me. These are all big issues. And let's not leave the province out of this. And I wish Mike was still here, because he would agree. If we do not radically reform rent controls, we are going to see rents continue to go out of control. Anybody that buys a house right now can increase the cost of a rental unit by the flick of a pen. And anybody who's a renter knows that. And this is a problem. It means that renters must stay where they are. And yet the pressure put on renters right now to leave is extraordinary. Just by way of example, one of the people who is one of the co-hosts of the show is looking for a new unit today because his landlord is selling. That particular free market inflates the rental market and increases homelessness. It increases underhousing and it creates social disparity. And without a provincial and a federal government willing to take this on, we must be very honest. Municipalities, whether it's the county or the city, are hamstrung in what we can do. We can put in all the inclusive zoning that we want, but if you don't give us the cash, we can't deliver.
Thank you for that perspective, Phil. And sounds like there's a lot of really good stuff that is waiting in the wings. And speaking of waiting in the wings, Tanya has some questions.
Okay, yes. The first one's going to be rather controversial. Guelph has a supported safe injection site. Is providing the choice to take dangerous drugs in permanent supportive housing actually enabling self-destructive behaviors?
So we have a consumption site in our community. I want to make it clear that supportive housing is different than that. It's important to remember that supportive housing is someone's rental. It's their place to call home. So although there are supports aligned with it, it's still someone's housing, right? So, and I don't actually know of models where they would pair a consumption site with supportive housing. I would say it's not best practice. So I think that's important and clear, a clear distinction to make, so people don't know that those two things are conflated and the same. We need both in our community. And then I think the other thing too, and I'm not an expert in addiction, and there's some really incredible agencies in our community that I would encourage people to check out for that information, like the Wellington Guelph Drug Strategy, and a number of the agencies that support harm reduction in our community. But I would say one of the things that we know through harm reduction related supports is that what best supports people is reducing harm. And we know that the opioid crisis is another crisis that's been happening in tandem with our housing crisis. And we have people are being lost and dying at an astronomical rate from drug poisoning. We could get on a whole big tangent about that. But I would argue that until people have support to meet them where they're at, and for them to be able to have wraparound care and support so that they stay alive and can access the substances in the way that they want and need. And that when those caring supports are available and when people can access harm reduction related supports that are destigmatizing, it creates a more welcoming environment that if people are in a place where they do want to not use anymore, that the supports are available to help. To help and provide access to supports with that. But I think if we put in place like rules and say that people cannot use, we know that what that results in is pushing people to greater margins and to more unsafe situations. And if people are struggling with addiction, which is a health issue, and they don't have access to safe services to meet their needs or to do what they need to do to transition for that, increase access to supports and wellness, that can further marginalize people when we put in place rules like that. And it can also create, and I don't think this is what was intended by the question someone was asked, but it can stigmatize people and it can actually put people at greater risk of death and dying and not getting the support that they need. So these supportive housing models being harm reduction focused, so trying to support people with using substances in a way that's safe and that people have a roof over their head and have access to meeting their basic needs in a number of form, increases wellness, and that's whether someone's using substances or not. And it creates wraparound care around someone too. And I think if we put in place rules, we actually know it often doesn't work, and it can actually make people more unsafe and more stigmatized and can make things worse. So that's part of the reason why those models are being put in a place that's harm reduction focused, and also respects people's rights to have privacy in their units, right? Like, these are people's rental units. They have rental rights. They have rights as human beings, and these will be their spaces, right? And those support services are not under their bed. They are nearby and easily accessible when people are coming in and out of the building, and then they'll be there to be able to access as they need and want. And often I know in looking at other models is people who use addictions, and it won't be everybody because these projects meet a number of different needs, and not everybody experiencing homelessness faces addiction. That's also not a reality. But I think it's just around centering around what people need and wants, and people are accessing housing because they want to increase opportunity, increase their access to basic needs and increase wellness, right? I mean, I don't know who doesn't want that. So I think that's one of the reasons why that approach, I would say, does not, you know, perpetuate it. It could actually risk making it worse and more dangerous for people. And it's actually providing that care on site and in that way that can help people to, access the supports that they need if they want to no longer be using substances in that way.
Thank you for explaining that, Dominika. In the Guelph Today article back in May, it was made mention that the $600,000 donation from St. Andrew's Church would help to leverage additional government grants. Would you please explain to me how that mechanism would work?
Yes, there's certain things that I don't believe I can fully say yet because they haven't officially been announced by the government. However, as with a lot of government funding, being able to provide proof of certain local fundraising commitments allowed us to be able to access certain government funding, and actually is allowing one of the projects that we believed was going to have a mortgage to potentially be fully mortgage free. So it's really, I think, kind of comes down to that sort of matching or just having some portion of the community funding that government agencies are looking for. So it's just helped make those amounts of funding possible.
Is there anything either of you would like to say very briefly before Tanya starts her announcements for the week?
I just want to say thank you, because I think another critical thing in here was that two of those projects needed to go through council planning and overcome zoning changes. And they went through that without an LPAT appeal and without an appeal. And I think like it's because of folks like you championing this, having conversations with people in your community. It's because of elected officials like Phil Ault and others who unanimously supported those decisions at council planning. And I just want to just say thank you. It's the care that folks like all of you are bringing and the engagement that you're bringing to these issues that helps to really shift and move the tides in our community to be a more caring one where everyone has a place to call home and one that's welcoming and supportive. So just thank you. None of this work would be possible without a caring community on the ground and behind the scenes, because that's where we'll see movement is through talking to the people we care about and the people that we know. And thank you, because I know a lot of you do this on a daily basis, and it may be seen and unseen, but I want to know that I see you and I see all the amazing things that you do, and I am incredibly, incredibly grateful.
Thank you, Dominika, and for all you do as well. Glenna.
Yeah, just to add to that, I just want to thank you for inviting us today. I've quickly learned over the last year that how important learning and increasing understanding, and unfortunately that there is still so much stigma in this area. And so all of us continuing to learn and share within our community, sometimes talking with some people that might typically donate, I've been shocked with some of the things and conversations that I've had. So us continuing to share the message of the importance and break down the misconceptions is so important. So thank you so much for listening and sharing more about these projects in the community. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so very much. And I am glad that we are able to provide the information to everyone and get the word out. With that, Tanya is getting her slides ready. Go ahead, Tanya.
Okay. So we've got a council planning meeting on Monday, July 18th at 6 p.m. There's going to be an update on supportive housing advisory group and the next steps. Urgent issues related to homelessness, mental health, and addictions. The community benefit charge and parkland dedication bylaws. And the 2023 council and committee meeting schedule. Have your say about the comprehensive zoning bylaw review. If you have any questions or comments, please email zoningreview@guelph.ca. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, the topic is financialization of housing with Sean Campbell of the Union Cooperative. Their motto is permanent affordability through community ownership. And with that, thank you all for being here, and I'll see you next week.